Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Larkin, Judge Eade, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Well, good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Our first case this morning is the State of Minnesota versus Brian, I hope I pronounced it correctly, Luck, case file number A24-0250. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant Brian Leak in this matter. Everyone agrees that it is unconstitutional to criminalize the act of refusing to submit to a warrantless search, specifically blood and urine test searches. That was explicitly shot down by the U.S. Supreme Court in Birchfield and by our Supreme Court in Thompson and Trahan. That's effectively the issue in this case. This case is primarily a constitutional case, less so a statutory interpretation case, because we know the legislature can grant additional protections to citizens than the Constitution does, but they can't take them away. If they try to say you can criminalize refusing to submit to a warrantless search, that's unconstitutional, and it's already been found unconstitutional. And that's the statute that's at stake in this case. 171.177 subdivision 2 says that it's a crime to refuse to submit to a blood or a urine test, but you get the right to submit to both. You get the option to say no to a blood test, and you also have to say no to a urine test before you can be convicted for test refusal. And nothing in the statutes is even capable of saying, but law enforcement doesn't need a warrant.
Do you have to say no to the alternative test? That's a very big part of your premise there, that in order to be convicted of refusal, because the statute and at least one prior decision of this court in a non-presidential case, the Atkins case, said the opposite, that the law enforcement just needs to offer that alternative test that in order for a refusal conviction to be sustained, there doesn't need to be a refusal of the alternative test.
And I apologize, that's not how I interpreted Atkins. I interpreted Atkins, which is unpublished or non-precedential, it was a statutory interpretation case that looked at the statute and said, basically, you don't need to have a warrant for both.
Counsel, following up on Judge Eade's question. As I understand your argument, it's premised on your belief that 171 point, what's the rest of it? I don't have in front of me.
177 subdivision
177
two.
Requires that in order to convict somebody of refusal, the person has to refuse both a blood test and a urine test.
That is correct. That is our argument.
Now, you say this case isn't about statutory interpretation, but I wonder if there isn't an argument that, given the way the statute is written, you could base a refusal conviction on refusal of the first test for which there was a warrant, which was refused, and then the requirement under the statute is merely to offer the alternative test. And if the person turns that down, why can't there just be a refusal based on the refusal of the warranted test? And I wonder if that's possible because the statutory language says that a test must be offered. It doesn't go on to say and objected to. So the way the statute's written, it talks about an objection to the initial test offered, which I think we all agree means refusal to take it. And then it speaks of offering the alternative without saying, and there must be an objection to that as well.
Yes, and that is the state's argument in this case. I do think the statute goes further.
Okay.
And specifically says, action may be taken against the person who refuses the blood only. Oh, you are correct. I was wrong.
So
only if a blood test
so
was
do you
offered.
So do you lose? Are we done?
No, Your Honor, I do
it's,
not.
It's only 10 minutes in. Perhaps we can leave now.
I'll try to keep things brief, but at the same time, no. I think that it's implied that the person is going to be refusing to both when you're saying you need to take action against them. Respondent cited to the Nash case, which is largely irrelevant for the purposes of this. Nash, they did get a warrant for blood and urine. Nash, the driver, submitted. They didn't refuse. And Nash was a civil case that was just dealing with an interpretation of how the advisory needed to be read. But there was some language in Nash going into the legislative history that talks about this subdivision and says the choice of test belongs to the officer unless the person objects. And then they went into the legislative history. And there it was, and that was in footnote 8 of the opinion, and they said that the legislature intended to authorize an alternative test once the person refused. And I think it's reading too much into the law to say that they only need to offer the test, not that the person has to refuse it. And
well, let's talk it through. So let's say they offer the test. Person says, yes, I'll take the alternative. There is no warrant for that. Well, then we wouldn't have a refusal, but we might have an argue about whether we have valid consent to take the alternative test.
And I would argue that that's absolutely bumper v. North Carolina, not consent.
Understood. Or we have refused the warranted test. Will you take the alternative? No. So your position is, well, at that point, they need to go get a warrant, or they didn't have a warrant, so it's too late. Does Nash, and I know I was reversed in Nash, I know what the issue was. I understand that they talked about this subdivision, but clearly the issue put before the court in Nash was the adequacy of the advisory that was given to the driver. This issue, and I think it's a issue of statutory interpretation, issue of first impression, does 171.177 require that the alternative test be refused in order to sustain a refusal charge? That wasn't the issue in Nash, was it?
No, you're correct, Your Honor. And my plain reading common sense interpretation of the statute is that it presupposes that the person refused. Otherwise, they couldn't be charged with refusal. The state could not take action against the individual.
But are you conceding that it was dicta, the portion of Nash that you just cited and are asking us to rely on, or do you think that the Supreme Court relied on that statutory interpretation in reaching its decision, so it should be binding on us? What's your position there?
They did use that language in reaching this decision, in their decision in Nash, but it just supports the common sense reading of the statute, that the officer does get the option to choose the first test. I'd prefer a blood test. But upon that point, the statute says, and the Supreme Court has interpreted it, that then the other person, the person being asked to submit to the test, needs to be given the option for the other test before they can be convicted. And all of this works perfectly if there's a search warrant for blood and urine.
But that's what happened here. I mean, what you just said, I mean, it's not Leek. How do you pronounce your client's last name? Leek.
Leek.
The test was offered, right? I mean, the test was offered. It's just the question is whether or not you need to have a warrant for that second test. I mean, you're only being prosecuted for the refusal of the first test. There's not two refusal counts, right? I mean, so why is a refusal necessary based on the language of the statute?
Because there's two elements to the refusal. I mean, refusal itself is broken down into refusing a breath test and refusing a blood or urine test taken pursuant to 171.177.
And it's blood or urine.
And it's blood or urine when it lists the crime. But then when it refers to 171.177, that's when we get the language that says, you know, it's more than just or. And that's what Nash said, is, yep, you only got to tell them about one test. But while you don't have to read 171.177 subdivision 2, this is what it means. It means they do have to be offered both tests.
Okay, but now we have one statute, the 160A, whatever, that says the crime of refusal in the context of bodily fluids is you refuse either to provide blood or to provide a urine sample. So that makes it sound like a refusal charge can be based on one or the other. It doesn't have to be both. And then we have 171, which says first test offered up to officer, but you have to offer an alternative. It says nothing about refusing the alternative. I mean, when you look at those statutes together, which address the same topic, since the statute that defines the crime of refusal specifically refers to 177, doesn't that support reading the two statutes together to say, well, the crime of refusal is based on one or the other? And as long as you had a warrant for one and the person refused that, there's no issue.
So 169A.20, the refusal statute, specifically incorporates 171.177. It says pursuant to that statute. So they do need to be read together. But that hypothetical interpretation of the language would apply with equal force if they didn't obtain a warrant at all. If they just said, I'm going to offer you a blood test, because we need to remember the statute presupposes that law enforcement is obtaining warrants, because otherwise these searches are
unconstitutional. Well, we have a warrant here. I don't think we need to talk about that hypothetical, because here there was a warrant for a blood draw.
But not for the test they asked for. They did ask for a blood test pursuant to a warrant,
okay. But
then they asked to execute a non-consensual urine search without a warrant. And I think that's where you can't make that offer because you've just threatened the person with a crime of refusal.
I agree with you, but the offer has to be made according to the statute. What I'm struggling with is why, to sustain a conviction of refusal, you have to refuse both a warranted warrant for a blood draw and a warrant for a urine sample, when the crime is defined as refusal of one or the other.
And I think that the language is ambiguous in that you...
Of 171?
171.177 with respect to the question of, does the person have to refuse or does it only need to be offered? Because it's implied that they need to refuse to be convicted of refusal. That the legislature would expect that to be a constitutional request for a urine search.
When interpreting statutes, aren't we to attempt to interpret them in a way that avoids a constitutional violation? And if so, wouldn't we apply that principle here and say, well, it's easy enough to do that. You just read the second component, the offering, face value, you just need to make the offer. What happens with that is irrelevant. And maybe the legislature did it that way because, well, now you're willing to take the other test, so you don't have to submit to the forced blood draw, and we've got the test, which is what we really want.
I think that interpretation actually provokes a sort of constitutional crisis with the statutory language, because it's telling law enforcement you can offer, you can threaten somebody with the crime of refusal and then say, all right, will you submit to a warrantless search of your urine, which has been found to be an unconstitutional crime. And so it brings a constitutional dimension into this that doesn't exist if you read it the other way. And then if it is still ambiguous, in this case, the rule of lenity would also suggest that we should do this in a way that makes sense. This whole statute was designed to protect the constitutional rights of drivers in the wake of Birchfield, Thompson, and Trahan. And so in that light, the legislature's looking to protect those rights but still be able to constitutionally charge somebody with the crime of refusal. And if that's premised on offering a search that law enforcement have no right to take, then that can't be constitutional, and that's an absurd reading of the statute. Unless there's any more questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Scott Hersey, Special Assistant Wadena County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. The main thrust of appellant's argument is that in a test refusal case, a law enforcement officer cannot even ask for an alternative fluid test unless a warrant has already been issued for that alternative test. And I submit that there is nothing in the DWI or implied consent sections of our statutes that provide that. Rather, the statutes state the opposite. In 169A.51 subdivision 3, it says that a blood or urine test may be conducted only pursuant to a search warrant. It does not say that such tests can only be offered after a search warrant for that alternative test has been obtained. And I'd submit there is a substantial difference between offering or requesting an alternative test versus actually taking that alternative test.
Do you agree that if an alternative test that's unwarranted is offered and a suspect consents to take that test, do you agree with the application of bumper that your counterpart articulated in his argument that that would actually be an unconstitutional, non-consensual search because it was done under this color of a warrant that didn't exist? And so in a situation like this, where the second test was unwarranted, there would be this somewhat perverse result, wouldn't you agree, where if someone agreed to take the test, then the evidence would be suppressible?
I don't know that I would agree with that, Judge, because as Judge Larkin had pointed out, the statute itself only requires the alternative test to be offered. And so I would say that, no, this would not be a bumper versus North Carolina.
But this isn't a statutory claim, though, right? I mean, this is a constitutional claim, right? As I read appellant's argument, it's not that the district court erred because it violates 171.177 subdivision 2, but because you need a warrant for the second search, and that's a constitutional requirement, right?
Yes, to obtain it, but not to request it. And that's where I basically follow Judge Larkin's argument that it's just the request that has to be made. And the statutes talk about obtaining the test pursuant to a warrant. So I would not say that simply making the request is unconstitutional.
But what if the person accepts the request and there's no warrant for that? Do you agree that that actually would then be a motion to suppress could be brought? Because under these facts, right, the second question was if you refuse, you're refusing blood or urine, the implication was that there was a warrant there. And so the person, if they consent, they could argue that that consent was invalid and unconstitutional. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that. And in fact, I think the officer in this particular case said specifically to the appellant that I have a warrant for blood. And then he asked him for that. And the fellow refused it. And then he asked Mr. Leek, well, so you're refusing blood and urine. He didn't say he had a warrant for that. He specifically told him he had a warrant for the blood, and he made the offer for the other thing. But I would submit that...
But we also read the implied consent advisory, right, that says if you don't consent, then it's a crime. And as part of that second question, right, about the urine, wasn't the specific refusal to test is a crime, so you're refusing both blood and a urine test, and that's where the bumper issue would come in, right? Is that you just told this person if they don't consent, it's a crime, and it's not a crime if there's no warrant, right?
I would say that's taking the interpretation a little far, because I would submit that if an officer in this situation goes ahead and ends up saying, I have a warrant for the blood, the fellow refuses it, and then the officer says, well, will you give a urine, and the person also refuses it, I would submit that there isn't any constitutional or statutory obstacle to that particular officer going out and getting a warrant at that point. I would submit that a person, an officer, can approach an individual and ask for consent to search, assuming there's not a stop issue, and if that person refuses, the officer can go get a warrant. And I would simply quote to State versus Thompson at page 233, and they said, in situations in which a breath test would not serve the government's interest, nothing prevents the police from seeking a warrant for an alternative test when there is sufficient time to do so.
And that's the problem, right? I mean, that's the problem is that the officer didn't ask for a warrant for the urine.
What prevents him from asking for it even if there's been a refusal? I would submit those, especially these days where warrants are done electronically and they're obtained in a matter of perhaps 10, 15 minutes, those are so closely related in time that it makes no statutory or constitutional difference if that refusal comes in the request comes before the officer goes out and gets the warrant. So I would submit that this officer could, in fact, have gone out and obtained a warrant for the urine if he had consented to urine. If he had consented to urine. But that's not the situation we're faced with here. He refused both. So I don't think we really have to look at that.
Okay, but what we do have to look at is appellant's position is in order to convict somebody, the crime of refusal in the context of bodily fluids requires refusal of a blood test and a refusal of a urine test. And the constitutional law is clear that you cannot constitutionally impose criminal liability under refusal statutes for refusing a test unless there was a warrant. So here we have a warrant for the blood test and a refusal of the blood test. We don't have a warrant for the urine test and a refusal of the urine test. If a conviction requires refusal of both types of tests, the state has a problem here.
Well, I would refer the court back to the language that shows up repeatedly in 169A.52, one of the subdivisions there, and 171.177, that again talks in terms of you need the warrant to obtain the test, not to request it. And I think there's a substantial difference there. And I think under the facts of this case, this is really an issue of statutory interpretation.
I need to stop you. The argument you just made, how do you square that with Birchfield, Thompson, and Trahan that all say you can't ask somebody, if you ask somebody to provide a blood or urine sample and you don't have a warrant, you can't charge them with refusal? And you're arguing here that it's okay to request it even if you don't have a warrant. That seems completely inconsistent with Birchfield, Trahan, and Thompson.
In Birchfield, Trahan, and Thompson, as I read those cases, the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court basically said for a test refusal, you can't, you know, obtain that test without a warrant. And
no,
my position
is
you can request it.
If you had obtained the test, there wouldn't be a refusal.
Right.
Right. So you can't obtain a test without a warrant. And then they also said, nor can you impose criminal liability on someone for refusing a test when there wasn't a warrant, because we don't allow someone to be made a criminal because they exercised a constitutional choice to refuse an unconstitutional search.
But I think that argument was implicitly rejected in the decision in Adkins. And I understand that that is not a precedential decision.
But Thompson and Trahan are Minnesota Supreme Court decisions in which the Minnesota Supreme Court said a charge of refusal is unconstitutional if it's based on a request for a bodily sample and the police did not have a warrant for the bodily sample.
And taking that in conjunction with Adkins, I think that is reading a little too much into Bridgefield, Trahan, and Thompson. Excuse me.
Okay, can I ask one question?
Sure.
And then I'll cease and desist. When we were going through all this litigation about do you need a search warrant for bodily samples, and I heard it asked of the state many times, including by former Chief Justice Gilday, why doesn't the state just get a warrant? Why not just get a warrant? And the state said, well, we can't possibly do it. It'll be too time involved, too cumbersome, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, U.S. Supreme Court says you need a warrant. Now the state's getting a warrant. So now I think the state has to be prepared to answer the question. As long as you're there getting a warrant and you've established probable cause for a blood draw, why in the world are you not asking that the warrant also apply to a urine sample so we don't have this issue?
That's a good point. But the situation is that interpretation would be require changing the statutory language to say you must offer urine, you must get a warrant that offers urine and blood. And the statute says or.
And I agree with you. You don't have to get a warrant for both. But if you don't get a warrant for both, and the person refuses the test that the warrant authorizes, and the officer is required to offer another test, and the state is going to take the position that they're going to charge refusal, why wouldn't you get the warrant for both? Not that you have to. You don't have to, but if you don't do it, you end up in this situation.
Well, I see this as a situation that was not answered in Trahan or Thompson. And that is an issue that perhaps is of first impression because it wasn't explicitly dealt with there. But I am saying that counsel's interpretation, I believe, is really a statutory interpretation issue, and I don't read Trahan and Thompson as being that specific to address this type of situation.
No, you're absolutely correct, because I don't think this statute 171177 was in existence at the time of Thompson and Trahan. So you're absolutely right. This is an issue of first impression, and it seems to me the issue is in order to convict a refusal, given the constitutional requirement that there be a warrant for the test refused, do you need to prove both a warrant of blood and urine, even though the refusal statute says you can have the crime of refusal based on blood or urine?
And I agree with the first of those. And to go back to your original question, why in the world wouldn't you get a warrant that authorizes blood or urine and then let the officer make his or her own first request for whichever one the officer chose? And I would submit in this case we have a criminal vehicular operation case where the officer, based on the minuscule amount of alcohol from the PBT test, believed that Mr. Leak was under the influence of a controlled substance, and the officer may well have wanted to get a blood sample so that the officer can get the quantification of the amount of controlled substance in Mr. Leak's blood, as opposed to a urine sample where the officer may only end up with a metabolite and can't do any sort of quantification of the actual controlled substance. So I think that was a major factor. And when I look at some of the other cases in this area, particularly when
are you suggesting there wasn't probable cause for a urine test?
Pardon me, Judge?
Are you suggesting that there wasn't probable cause for a urine test and that's why he got blood?
No. I would submit that if, in fact, the officer had probable cause for the blood sample, the same facts would justify probable cause on the facts of this case for the urine sample. But I'm simply saying that the officer most likely believed that a blood sample would be more complete than the urine sample, and that's why he asked just for blood. And I've seen that in some other cases coming out of this court where an officer believing the person is under the influence of a controlled substance goes ahead and asks for blood only. And that's the way the statute reads. You can get a blood-only warrant, you can get a urine-only warrant, or you can get one that says you get either one. But I would simply say, since my time is drawing to a close, I would ask this court to follow the Atkins decision because I think it is persuasive under Rule of Appellate Procedure 136.01. And I would submit that it is the statute requires the offer, and that that is not prohibited by Trahan and Thompson because I don't think they went that far. And therefore, I would ask the court to uphold the conviction. Thank you.
Can I ask?
Yes, go right ahead.
Sorry, I just have one question for you. In Nash, the Supreme Court said that Subdivision 2 of 171.177, quote, says that if the person refuses the type of test the officer initially offers, paren, blood or urine, end paren, action may not be taken against the person for test refusal unless the person is also offered and refuses to take the other type of test. Is that dicta or is it binding on us?
Well, that is what the statute says, and there has to be compliance with that, but I would submit that the offer or request for the test initially is not unconstitutional, and that is all that the statute requires.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear for counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court. I've had some additional time to ponder whether or not the statute should be read to require just the offer or the offer and refusal. And again, if it's just the offer and that satisfies the state's requirements, it does open up a host of additional constitutional worries. According to the plain language of the statute, the officer could have asked for the urine test first. And if Leek said no, he just had to offer the blood test. And that's nonsensical. What if Leek had asked to see the warrant and the officer had said no or admitted he didn't have one? Or told him, I don't have one, but I could easily get one. I mean, these are all situations in the case law that have been shot down. Law enforcement can't threaten somebody unconstitutionally, and then when they acquiesce, run back and get the warrant. The same way you can't take a non-Mirandized statement and then later Mirandize the person and ask them the same questions. So I do think the logical interpretation and the best interpretation of the statute is that the person does have to refuse both tests, and it needs to be a constitutional request for test. The court asked respondents' counsel about that language in Nash. I think it's persuasive, but that specific language, I hate to say this, but I think it is dicta. It wasn't relevant to the issue at stake, which was just, how is that advisory to be provided?
Well, that's why I asked you if you thought the Supreme Court relied on that analysis in reaching its decision.
The specific language the court cited, I don't think so. But the other language where they do talk about how the choice of test belongs to the officer unless the person objects, which again presupposes the language that I do think is dicta from Nash, that, yeah, they have to not only be offered, but they have to say no. I mean, at its core, it is a refusal statute. And
I appreciate your candor there. I mean, it's interesting to me because the face of the statute doesn't tend to, I understand the implications that the scenarios you just talked about, but the face of the statute doesn't tend to support respectfully what the Supreme Court has characterized about the refusal aspect in that language from Nash. And Atkins seems to be consistent with the face of the statute. And so it's, you know, if Nash, that language is binding, it seems very helpful to you. But if it's not, Atkins seems very persuasive against your position. And what's your response to that?
The same argument I raised at the beginning of my argument is that Atkins went straight to statutory interpretation and didn't consider the constitutional dimension to these requests.
I framed it in questioning your counterpart as an issue, a constitutional issue, but really, I don't know if that's right, because the issue is what's a crime under the statute, right? And so if, obviously there was a warrant for the first test offered, and you can't criminalize a warrantless request that's refused for the blood. But the statute as an element only requires that there be an offer. On its face, absent this additional language from Nash, only requires that there be an offer. And so it is kind of an issue of statutory interpretation that would tend to suggest that Atkins rightly decided, wouldn't you say?
And I do think it is more than that, because of all the litigation that's gone into the warrant requirement for blood and urine tests and the somewhat absurd results you get if you're in a situation where law enforcement are only obtaining a warrant for one of the two tests, yet asking for both. And I think that's the key distinguishing factor between this and Atkins. And I think that the Nash court was just reading that into the language because it's the most common sense interpretation of how this crime is expected to lay out. It doesn't, the whole subdivision in 171.177 is there to protect drivers. That's the reason it exists. If somebody's afraid of needles, they get to do a urine test. If somebody doesn't want to urinate in front of an officer, they've got the option for a blood test. They have to say no to both. And the whole statute is designed to protect drivers by requiring a warrant before the officer can make the request. And I think in that light, it's fundamentally a different analysis and a different conclusion than what was reached in Atkins. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted.